We have a very, very special guest today. That's Jim M. Buskey, who knows pretty much everything about the American Revolution. And I don't know how to say this. He's a pretty big deal, and his bookshelves smell of rich mahogany. And basically, you worked on a podcast at Mount Vernon in the library there, and that was one of the top 100 podcasts, I believe.
Yeah, we intertwined the enslaved community of George Washington's Mount Vernon, reached, I think, we hit 67 at our peak. And that was, when did we release that one? 2021. Yeah, right. Late 2021 into early 2022.
Wow. That's, and you had a conversations one as well.
Right. Yeah. I was host of Conversations at the Washington Library, which I just slipped into my introduction there, my intro voice for that series. I hosted that between 2019, when I joined the Fred W. Smith National Library for the City of George Washington, which has since become the George Washington Presidential Library, and ended my tenure on that show when I left in October of 2022.
And what did you do after that? That was, trying to remember what you did after. You're George Mason University now,
yep.
Right?
Okay. Yeah, I'm the co-head of R2 Studios, which is the podcast component of the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
That's pretty cool. So you have a lot of podcasting experience then.
Yeah.
Kind of like a
podcast
history.
Yeah, I kind of sort of found my way into this profession. I was trained as a traditional historian. I did do digital humanities during my graduate program, but then now I make podcasts for a living. So
that's pretty cool. I bet was that the kind of the trajectory of where you wanted to go when you got into history?
Completely unexpected. I fell into podcasting by virtue of the fact that I got hired at Mount Vernon, and part of the responsibilities of running for the Center for Digital History there was hosting Conversations. And then out of that, we began to develop a narrative series. Intertwined was the first narrative series then. And then when I was leaving, we were developing series with my colleagues Ann Furtick and Alexandra Montgomery. And subsequently, after I left, they had successfully produced a couple of series called Inventing the Presidency and then Secrets of Washington's Archive, which are very good.
I just actually got into that, started getting into that. So I'm very excited about that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, so right at the beginning, I told you I just learned something about you yesterday. It was really cool. You got to actually go to Windsor Castle and study in the archives there.
Yep.
And you got to see unpublished letters from George III.
Yep.
And there was something you discovered. Can you tell me about that, about how we misunderstood something?
A couple of things, actually. Yeah, I was really lucky in 2015. I applied for a fellowship through the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture down here in Williamsburg, Virginia. Well, I'm not actually in Williamsburg, so not down here, but over that way in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Yeah.
As part of something called the Georgian Papers Program, which was an initiative to digitize the papers of the Georgian kings and their families in the Round Tower at Windsor Castle. And so if you've been to England, if you've been to Windsor, and you've seen Windsor Castle, and you'll see it on TV all the time because it was Queen Elizabeth's like favorite English home. Balmoral was her favorite Scottish home, but the Round Tower is the kind of defining feature of that space, and the Royal Archives are in there. And so by sheer stupid luck, I got to go in to be one of the fellows to go look through King George III's papers. And I was looking for evidence that the king was thinking about Scottish immigration, which we may talk about here in a little bit. But what I've found is there's this very famous purported essay, that was thought to be the king's alone call on the loss of the American colonies. And it was a very sort of short essay talking about the king lamenting the loss of the American colonies and where do we go from here. But there's a pathway forward because we can be an empire of trade, which the empire had always been, but we don't need to hold territorial empire anymore. We can be an empire of free trade. And so the Royal Archives thought it was this it's in the king's hand, you know, and I held the piece of paper. The Royal Archives always thought it was the king's essay. And I should say that the king was a very, very devout reader, both religiously, but also in the sense of reading a lot. He read a lot of political theory, economic theory, history, and he would compose these sort of summations or these little essays about things he had read. And something, that essay has always bothered historians. Why would the king, who fought so hard to keep the empire together, who actually in 1784 drafts a letter of abdication, he's prepared to leave the throne to his son because he believes that he's failed his duty as the king. Why would he, as one of my colleagues described it, why would he take this sudden U-turn? And it turns out it wasn't him, but it was a reflection of his reading habits. What he had done is he had copied part of an essay by a guy named Arthur Young, who was a really important English agriculturalist. He was a friend of the king. He would advise the king on agricultural matters. And he, in, I think, 1784, began publishing this long-running series called The Annals of Agriculture. And in like the first essay of this first volume is that passage. So the king had read that passage and excerpted it. Now, it's still significant, right, that the king did that, that it tells us something about what the king is thinking about in that moment when he has, in his mind, failed to keep the empire together, and where do we go from here? But it wasn't the king's original idea. It was Arthur Young's, who incidentally was also a major correspondent of George Washington.
And you got to correct that. You got to like let us know, hey, George III actually thought this.
I remember the moment, actually, because I'm sitting in the round tower in the old reading room where and there's a new reading room now where the fellows go. But I was sitting in the original reading room and I was reading it. And then I started doing some Googling because that's what you do these days. Like, oh, let's just see who else has cited this passage, what people have said about it. And through a period of intense Googling, I made my way back to Arthur Young. Google had digitized that first volume and that essay, and there it was. And I remember looking up to Oliver Wolcott, who was the administrator of the program at the time, and he's sitting off to my right because they, you know, they watch you like a hawk in there, right? Because you're in the king's. And I'm like, Oliver, I think I found something. And I think from what I understand from subsequent conversations, there was some initial sort of disbelief that what I had found was right, but turns out that it was. And it was...
Now, where do you go from there? Like, that's just the top. Yeah. Like, correcting something we think about George III. Yeah. That is so cool.
As the kids say, it was pretty dope. You know, I was really lucky. Every historian wants to make some kind of contribution to our knowledge. And,
that's crazy.
You know, if that's the last thing I do or the most important thing I do, subsequent people have written about this, Angel Young or Angel O'Donnell, who is one of the program administrators for the GPP, has written about this. That's one of my most significant contributions. I'm good.
My God.
Yeah.
George, correct me if I'm wrong, but George III had a habit of, since he was a young boy, his tutors had him writing essays that other people said, and that was part of just what he did since he was a kid. And so it makes sense that he would write down an essay of something somebody else said.
Right. You know? It was part of his education. I mean, he had very, very knowledgeable tutors, including the Earl of Bute, who would later become one of his first prime ministers when he became king. In 1760, Bute becomes prime minister shortly thereafter. But it was part of his education in kingship. I think one of the things that we don't realize about the monarchs in the 18th century is that they are not as powerful as they were in the 17th century, but they are, George III particularly is a product of the Glorious Revolution. He is a product of the world in which Parliament rules alongside the crown. And he still has a pretty considerable amount of power. He's not the symbolic head of state that the monarchs are today. he can still choose and fire his prime ministers as he wants to. And he really believes, and his father instilled this in him, and his Bute instilled this in him, that it is incumbent upon you to be a good king. And that requires knowledge, but that requires wisdom. And wisdom is the product of time. And so he spent a lot of time reading, spent a lot of time thinking about kingship, about political theory, about his duty as a king to the British subjects on both sides of the Atlantic. And so part of his reading and his essay and his writing was part of this education.
And would you say that, you know, there's this idea that he was really misunderstood. Americans are like, rawr, King George III. And, you know, when you really get into it, it seems like there's kind of this, I don't want to say new, but kind of new-ish idea, and books are coming out about, like, he was really this, like, kind of good guy who wanted to do good, but he kind of sucked at being good sometimes.
Yeah.
Was that like?
Yeah, I think our perception, particularly in the United States, is our perception is colored by two things. One, the revolution, because he becomes the focal point of the revolution by virtue of being the person targeted in the Declaration of Independence. You know, that's basically a legal indictment of the way that the king has failed the Americans. But two, the mental illness that manifests itself beginning really in the late 1780s, but more especially in 1811 after his daughter Amelia dies, overshadows our perception of him and this idea that he is the mad king. But you're right. Like there's been a lot of scholarship in part because of the Georgian Papers program that has begun to, one, give us a better understanding of his mental illness. We have access to all his doctor's books who are treating him and what he's going through. But more importantly, the papers themselves gives you a clearer sense of what he believed was right. And I think what we have to remember is that by and large, until really the final break, British Americans were a monarchical people, not as to the intensity as British subjects were in Great Britain, but they still had a reverence for the monarchy. They believed that their individual colonies were attached to the empire through the monarchy and the crown, and that George III was a good king. In a concrete example is in 1766, the New York General Assembly votes to erect a gilded equestrian statue of him in Bowling Green on the southern tip of Manhattan because it's known that George III sided with the Earl of Rockingham, who was his prime minister, and backed the repeal of the Stamp Act, that the British had made a mistake and that the system had corrected itself and that the king was there and had their back in the end. And so they have a reverence for the monarchy. They have a reverence for George III.
Yeah.
The revolution.
Right up until the end, like even in the Continental Congresses, you can see they're like his most magnificent majesty that we love and we're your subjects. And it's like they're right on the edge of declaring independence, but please don't make us.
Well, and I think that's a really, really insightful point. And one of the things I think that also gets misunderstood about the revolution is that the goal, when what we call the imperial crisis starts really in 1765 with the Stamp Act, but with the war beginning in April of 1775, is not independence. It is reconciliation. Now, there are some outliers. There are some radicals who entertain the idea of independence. But if you look at people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, they're what we call imperial Virginians. They think that it is better to stay in the empire. And Jefferson especially, and I think this kind of explains why he is kind of angry about and so passionate about the revolution when the final break comes, is that he and many others, they desperately want to find a way out of this situation. They want to go back to the status quo of 1763 when everything was great in their minds. They don't want to go.
If I remember right, in the first Continental Congress, there was some infighting between kind of the more loyalists and the more radical kind of Massachusetts independence seekers, patriots, they called themselves, about should we even talk about anything that was before 1763. Let's only talk about everything that came after it. And there was some arguing over, like, no, we want to talk about everything. And no, we want to only talk about the Stamp Act and just a couple of things. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, what begins to happen is you see, and Patrick Griffin, a colleague of mine at the University of Notre Dame, will actually say this in an upcoming episode of our podcast series, World's Turned Upside Down, is that once we get past the Stamp Act, and particularly we get into the Townsend duties and then the massacre, the Boston Massacre in March of 1770, is that a lot of British Americans begin to see events that are not really connected to each other. They begin to connect the dots and think about them as a kind of a pattern of oppression. So by the time you get to the Continental Congress, the first one in 1774, you do have a faction who was more radicalized. You can count sort of Samuel Adams and John Adams among them, who are, I wouldn't say they're necessarily thinking about independence at this point, but it's in the back of the mind. But then you have people like Joseph Galloway from Pennsylvania, who is, I guess we can say, more conservative side, who is more willing to try to find a way out of the impasse. He proposes this plan of union where there would be essentially an American parliament headed by a president general who would be appointed by the king, and so that there would be some representation and things like that. And that plan fails by one vote. Now, whether or not parliament would have accepted that, because they're already not too happy with the idea of a Continental Congress to begin with, is another question. But that kind of shows you that it's very divisive, and that there's a slight majority still that wants to stay in the family.
That's so insightful. Just looking at all of those things, or people, I think Americans generally have this idea that, oh, we're just going to declare independence and we want freedom from Britain. And that really wasn't the case. Right. It was out of a desperation. There's no other option. That's really interesting to think about those things and look at those records and one vote.
So close.
Wild. So close. But like you said, it probably would, a parliament probably would have been like, no, like, what are you even, what is this?
Well, and they're already unhappy about the Continental Congress because it's an extra legal body. And it's not a Congress as we would think about it now. Congress, the word Congress in the 18th century up until this point just means a meeting or a gathering. By 1774, when the first Continental Congress meets, it is beginning to assume sort of legal and constitutional powers. But the Second Continental Congress in 75, that will really take on those kinds
that's
of roles.
That.
Yeah.
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 Well, that's cool. If I could shift gears for a moment to your Scottish research, I'm super excited to ask you about that. There's not a lot of information, at least when we're growing up or in high school, there's not a lot of information about this. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Where to even start with this? You worked on the Scottish Court of Session project. And that was kind of taking everything from the 16 and 1700s, the legal documents, cases in Scotland. Mm-hmm. Is that what that was?
Right.
Okay. And did you get to see anything between maybe that kind of indicated how people in Scotland felt about the building the American Revolution? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So when I was a postdoctoral fellow in digital history at the University of Virginia Law Library, my project was to work on this thing called the Scottish Court of Session Digital Archive Project. And just for your listeners, the Court of Session is Scotland's supreme civil court. And in 1710, the court mandated that everything that is given to the judges be printed. So that's your legal briefs, that's your evidence, all that kind of stuff. There are oral arguments, but everything is given to the judges in print, in part because they're doing so much business that the thinking was, well, there'll be less errors from copying handwritten manuscripts if we just print these things and run them off. And so there'll be like 20 copies apiece. So the idea in that project then was to digitize the portion that UVA strangely had for whatever reason. But then we began to build out various institutional partnerships with the University of Edinburgh and the Signet Library and the Faculty of Advocates Library.
Wow.
So to answer your question, yes and no. What you see is a reflection in these cases during the mid-18th century of life happening and going on as it always does in some sense. So these cases are civil and not criminal, what you're seeing are, you know, merchants suing each other, land disputes, divorce cases, things like that. So you're seeing kind of the lived experience. Now, with that said, you know, a lot of the things we would see is because the colonies are so intimately tied to Scotland, and particularly Virginia through trade, you see a lot of interesting cases about disputes between merchants and, you know, places in Virginia where a business deal has gone wrong or someone's not paid their debts. And the people in Virginia have instructed their Scottish attorneys to go sue the Glaswegian merchants in the Court of Session.
Very cool. Very cool.
But then what you see in the aftermath of the war is the fallout from independence. Really, that's when you start to see Glaswegian merchants starting to sue Virginians to recover debts. You start to see families trying to make a claim to American property that they have been bequeathed or left or is in some kind of state of uncertainty because of the war. And so, you know, the war ends and the military conflict ends in 1783, but in a lot of ways, the legal war continues, you know, long into the 1820s. And you can see that bearing out in some of these documents.
You just get lost in those. I could get lost for days. Did you just read like, oh my God, look at the time I've been in.
Yes, it's like, yes, that was one of the, it was the good thing and the bad thing. I'm like, no, I have five more minutes and I'll come home. I've just got to read, you know, I've got to read through this petition one more time or, you know, look through it. So,
yeah, I often find myself when I'm reading primary sources, just like, oh, my God, this is so scandalous. How is everyone not freaking out about, even though it happened like hundreds of years ago, it like feels like it's happening right now.
Yeah.
Do you have to?
And this is a Scottish case in particular, and I don't remember the case name, but it was from the early 19th century. I want to say that the case was either happening in Dunbar or Dumfries in Scotland, but it was a divorce case between a husband and a wife. And as part of the lawsuit, there was a ton of correspondence between the husband and the wife and the husband and her father. And you watch over the course of this correspondence, this marriage falling apart. And it's really sad, but it's, but you have it all there sort of documented. And then conversely, right, you see really interesting cases like the case of Daniel Graham in 1781, who was a formerly enslaved man who was made to work on a ship out of Glasgow trading between Scotland and Honduras. But in 1781, the Royal Navy tries to impress him into the Royal Navy service, in part because they need men to fight the American Revolution, but that's also become an international war at this point. And the really fascinating thing is that the impressment officer says, well, you are fully capable of being a Royal Navy sailor because you have experience as a merchant and as a seaman, as a mariner. And he says, but I was made to do that under duress because I was enslaved. And so technically, I never had any formal training as a mariner. I was just someone made to do something because of my legal status as a slave. And that argument worked. The court said you can't impress him because he was never trained as a mariner because he was an enslaved person held against his will.
And you're reading this whole thing, kind of watching it unfold.
Right.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool.
That is so cool.
Yeah. Okay. I've got a million questions about Scottish.
Good. I have time.
So I kind of came across this idea that there was an element of Scottish immigrants in American colonies that were pro-British a little bit, which was, it's kind of shocking to me considering the whole Jacobite rebellion and the James II. What the heck is that about? Was that really a thing?
Yeah, it's weird, right?
Like, why?
It's counterintuitive. Right. And you're right. There is a significant, and this is what I study, right? I study Scots immigrants. That's my primary area of interest is Scots immigrants to the colonies in the revolutionary period. And so you've got these mass movements of people from like the Isle of Skye, from Isla, from Lewis, from Harris, from Caithness and Sutherland and places like that. From the Highlands in particular, it infects the Lowlands too. They call it like an epidemical frenzy of immigration. But you see, beginning in the aftermath of the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, Scots moving to North America, particularly Georgia, North Carolina, New York, Jamaica as well, and Virginia, but for different reasons. But Highlanders in particular going to New York, Georgia, and North Carolina. Some of these people had participated in the Jacobite Rebellion. Flora MacDonald, who, you know, fans of Outlander will know as appeared in recent seasons and in the books, Flora MacDonald was a real person from the Isle of Skye. She had helped Bonnie Prince Charlie escape in 1746, and she was attained in London for a time. But she and her family immigrate from Skye in 1774. So you have a lot of folks who had survived one revolution in the 1740s or one failed revolution in the 1740s, and then suddenly find themselves caught up in another one. But they, by and large, this immigrant wave from the 1760s onwards stays loyal, and it's weird, right? It doesn't seem like
that
it makes
really,
sense.
Like, what is that?
And part of it is because, one, enough time has passed that there is that Jacobitism is on the kind of way out. Really, post 1745, and there are people who are more knowledgeable about the rebellion itself and its aftermath than I am, but the finality of the Battle of Culloden in 1746 and the government's restrictions on various parts of Highland culture in its wake does a lot to diminish Jacobitism. But what it also does is begins to reorient loyalties towards London, towards the crown, but particularly more to the idea of the British Empire itself. And I think that's the kind of key, that the empire is an empire of opportunity, that if you are no longer as successful as you might have hoped in Scotland, that you know the Scottish clan is failing, that the land itself is failing you, that there is this place in British America where you can go, you can get land on your own right. You don't have to be a renter anymore. You can get your own land and you can still enjoy all the trappings of British liberty and British rights and be part of this great empire. And you see a lot of Highlanders in this period who have migrated to the colonies say, including a lot who had participated in the Jacobite Rebellion, that this is possible because we live in this empire and that empire is worth defending. And so you will see then Scots, predominantly those who came after 64 or 63, right, take up arms in defense of the king and in defense of the empire against the American revolutionaries.
That makes sense when you put it that it's kind of like, you know, protecting, what's that, the hierarchy of needs,
right.
Kind of like your own self and your own family is going to be more protected if you remain in the empire, as opposed to these lofty idealist goals of who should be on the throne.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And we have to remember too, I think in the revolutionary period, the default is loyalty, right? The revolutionary is the kind of aberration. And as we've talked about earlier, they got to the point where they didn't think they had a choice anymore, but to break with that loyalty. But you've got this whole other set of people who are still adhering to the crown for whatever reason, still adhering to the empire and willing to fight for it.
That's amazing. When you think about it like that, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Right.
I wanted to ask you also about Scottish contributions to the American Revolution, where, again, you really don't hear about the Scots in the American Revolution. You hear mostly, obviously, about British descendants and a couple pockets here and there of other groups. But was there a significant contribution towards the effort or the fight from Scots in the colony? And could it have gone differently if the Scots hadn't been involved?
Interesting counterfactual.
Double question.
Yeah, so do you mean like, are we talking like from the Patriot side of things, the Loyalist side of things?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Patriot side.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it kind of, to take our previous discussion about post-63 immigrant Scots, the ones who come in like the 1730s and 1740s, they are loyal to the rebel cause. Because there is a significant earlier migration and they have been, I guess, seasoned, as you might say, in American politics. They have become acclimated to colonial ways of thinking that allows them to make that conceptual break. So you see people like Hugh Mercer, actually, who survives the Jacobite Rebellion, and he later fights in the French and Indian War, but he's, you know, he's an American general, or he's an American officer during the Revolution. James Wilson, John Witherspoon, actually, John Witherspoon is somebody I write a lot about. John Witherspoon was a minister from Paisley. He was a Presbyterian minister, immigrates in 1768, so he's kind of different in the sense of these Highland folks, but he's instrumental in securing passage of the Declaration of Independence, but more importantly, he is instrumental in removing a passage that Jefferson had written that actually cast aspersions on Scots.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, the original draft of the Declaration included a passage, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, by Jefferson, who wrote that the king had sent foreign mercenaries in Scotch to complete their works of death, desolation, and destruction amongst us. And Witherspoon is a very large proponent of Scots immigration. He's been helping lowlanders come over, you know, since his own immigration. There's no sort of direct passage where he says, I took it out, but the circumstantial evidence, the contextual evidence is pretty clear that it was him, that he removes this from there. Otherwise, Jefferson would have been damning Scots, which is not a good look, right? When you're trying to get all these other, you know, different ethnic communities on your side.
Could that have turned people from the cause?
Yeah, and it's a very kind of Virginia reference too, because there are a lot of Virginians who are annoyed with Scots in this period because they are all indebted to Scottish merchants. And so you see a lot, particularly among smaller planters, you see a lot of anti-Scottish rhetoric in Virginia in this period. But Witherspoon's like, no, we're trying to create this some semblance of something called an American. And if you start singling out people who are in America, who are of a particular ethnicity, that's not going to go well.
Amazing. That kind of like sets a foundation of the identity of Americans and how we're all kind of all these different ethnicities.
Right.
And that's cool.
Right,
that's really cool.
We have to remember, like, there is no, there, like the way I like to put it is there are a people in America, but there is no American people. They would not have thought about themselves in those terms. They thought about America as a place. It's kind of like, to paraphrase Thor Ragnarok, where Odin says, Asgard is not a place, it's a people. Right now, America is only a place, not a people, but it will become that as a consequence of defining themselves in opposition against the British, in opposition against indigenous people, against loyalists, and so that it takes a long time to get there.
Nice Thor reference. Speaking of random quotes, I had this thought that popped into my head the other day. I wanted to ask you before I forget about it. In the American Revolution and all kind of the background to it, you have all these really heavy hitters from Virginia, like almost like disproportionately, like Virginia's just popping out these heavyweights of the revolution. And there, it just reminded me of this phrase about astronauts and Ohio and where, you know, most astronauts are from Ohio. And there's this kind of phrase of what is it about Ohio that makes you want to flee the planet, you know? I'm thinking of Virginia, like, what is it about Virginia that just bred this kind of man? Is there anything that kind of comes to mind with why it was so concentrated there?
Yeah. Well, as a native Ohioan, I can say we're not trying to flee. We're just trying to touch the stars. But you're right. There seems like, you know, there's an emergence of a group of people in Virginia that in some ways sort of seems disproportionate to the rest of the colonies, right? With the exception probably of Massachusetts, who is cranking out, you know, James Otis and Sam Adams and Mercy Otis and you know, Abigail Adams and John. But in Virginia, I think, you know, what you have is a situation that is a reflection of the society in which people like George Washington live. So they live in a very hierarchical society. They live in a slave society where, you know, they are the masters of human beings and other, you know, indentured servants and whatnot. And they are also, you know, along with sort of the South Carolinians and the Jamaicans, the white Jamaicans, they have pretensions to have this kind of aristocratic society that exists in Britain that doesn't really exist in the colonies, but in their minds, they kind of think it does. And so they are very much culturally English. They are attuned to the trappings of hierarchy and the presentation of power in all its forms. And so thinking about, you know, how you dress, how you, you know, one of the things we say in Intertwined, the enslaved community at George Washington's Mount Vernon, like having control over human beings, right, gives you a certain status and gives you a certain prominence. So Washington, in particular, and Jefferson emerge out of this cultural milieu where they are expected by virtue of the families that they come from the wealth that they inherit and subsequently pursue, to be of men of prominence and be men of position. And so in order to achieve their goals as men of status, they enter politics and you see them become very prominent players in the revolutionary period. Ironically enough, you know, Patrick Henry, who's also someone who is a planter, also an enslaver, also someone who aspires to theatricality through his orality, he's lesser wealthy, but he becomes prominent in part because, I think it was Adams referred to him as the Demosthenes of the revolution, like this powerful orator who could distill a sense of American rights down to its basic common denominator and articulate that in ways that inspired people. So
he could, yeah.
But, you know, Henry's also a first generation American. His father and uncle were Scottish immigrants and his uncle was a minister. So he probably heard his uncle delivering sermons, and that, you know, contributed to his abilities to convey, you know, things to the public.
So you're saying, you know, slavery was a big part right. of why people got this kind of sense of identity of like, I'm supposed to do these
right.
kinds of things.
Right.
And it's interesting, since slavery is pretty much everywhere in the colonies, it's interesting that it was more in Virginia, probably because tobacco required
right.
enormous amounts of slaves and a huge slave population. Would that have contributed to that sense of self kind of being more prevalent in Virginia?
Yeah. And I think the same way, you know, in Virginia, particularly in sort of, you know, what we call the Tidewater, you know, around the Potomac and whatnot, and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, but also South Carolina. I mean, these are societies that are growing cash crops like tobacco and rice and indigo. They are, you know, heavily reliant on enslaved labor. And that is both an economic system and a social system. And so they need enslaved people to grow their tobacco, but they also need them socially so that they can display their dominance over people they see as, you know, lesser than themselves, certainly.
That's very well put.
Yeah.
I again, with the school, schools are very limited on what they can say just because there's so much
right.
of it. I think that is a detail that gets kind of glossed over a lot.
I think you're right. And, you know, you know, my wife is a teacher, and so I'm extremely sympathetic to the struggle
yeah.
of teachers. I mean, I think what we just have to recognize as a society is that this is what happened. We are trying our best to explain it. You know, right. You can hate the person, you can like the person. It kind of doesn't matter. It happened, and the historian's job is to unpack why it happened and what its consequences were. And if we can at least agree on that, then we can have good discussions, I think, about the past.
I agree. I kind of liken it sometimes to investigative discovery.
Yeah.
You're not condoning everything that happened, but you're like, why did it happen? What
right.
happened? What does it mean? You know, kind of thing. And before we end here, I wanted to ask you a couple of more non-historic
sure.
kind of personal questions. First of all, what drew you to Scottish immigration and the American Revolution?
Really great question. So the way that this happened is, so my wife also has her PhD, Sarah has her PhD in English Tudor history. And so she studied Henry VIII. And in 2008, she was going for her first big research trip. And so I went with her, and she had been to England. I had never been to Europe before. And so, you know, I went, but neither of us, of course, had been to Scotland. So we went to Edinburgh. We went to the castle there on the, you know, sort of the remnants of this ancient volcano, if you've been there, along the Royal Mile. And the dungeon there is interpreted as it was in the Revolutionary era, where American sailors who had been captured by the British were kept. And so on that door, the big wooden door that still is there, you see inscribed on the door sort of an early stars and stripes that a sailor had carved and images of his ship. And I thought, that's it. You know, I knew I was going to come back to do my PhD. I'm like, that's wow. going to be what I'm going to write about. But at least at the time, I couldn't find a whole lot of sources. So, but as I was searching around, I came across John Witherspoon, and Witherspoon defending himself against Scots in Scotland who were accusing him of what they called depopulation, of robbing Scotland of its people and encouraging them to come to the colonies in ways that are counterproductive for everybody. And the more I kept pulling on that thread, the more excited I got. And that's how I started researching that topic. I'm not the first to write on it, but what I'm really interested in is how that there's sort of two imperial crises, one where the colonists are arguing with Great Britain and one in Scotland where they are trying to figure out how to stem the flow of these people who are leaving for the colonies right at the wrong time.
What a cool origin story, because yeah. you eventually got to go in those records yeah. in the Court of Session project.
Yeah, yeah.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
One last question. Sure. This is kind of a standard question that we want to ask everybody. If you could time travel and talk to any person, who would it be?
Oh, my gosh. They're like, I mean, there's so many people, right? I mean, Flora MacDonald, I mentioned. James Boswell, who was kind of the first biographer. He was a kind of a despicable human being, but also he was a gifted writer who had great insight into the human condition. But I will say, since I'm on the spot, actually, somebody I've been thinking about since my intertwined days is a guy named Harry Washington. Harry was an enslaved person at Mount Vernon. He escaped, we think, sometime in 1776, and he joined Lord Dunmore's Ethiopian regiment, which was eventually evacuated to New York. And he served the British the duration of the war. And he was eventually part of the evacuation of loyalists, both white and black. And in his case, he went to Nova Scotia for a time. So there's a huge migration of black loyalists who go to Nova Scotia after the war. And they face a lot of trials and tribulations, including discrimination, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
Some of them then decide to emigrate to the new British colony of Sierra Leone in the late 18th and early 19th century. And Harry becomes a prominent member of that community, particularly in the Methodist community. And when the British start to try to impose new laws and regulations on that colony, Harry and the other black migrants begin to use the language of the American Revolution against them. And so it kind of becomes full circle, right? And so I would love to sort of sit down and talk with him about those experiences, that kind of journey
yeah.
from slavery to freedom to revolutionary in a real sense,
yeah.
From Virginia through New York to Nova Scotia and then to Sierra Leone. Like what was that journey like, and what kind of sense did he make of it? Because I don't know if we actually have anything in his own words. We just, you know, part of the historian's job is to reconstruct the past sometimes based on impressionistic or contextual evidence that we know somebody was there. We can start to rebuild their lives based on other evidence we have, but not necessarily something in their own words. So
I'm actually going to go look that up when we're done here, because that's amazing.
Well, my colleague Cassandra Pivas has a great book called Journeys to Freedom, and Harry's story is in there.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's where I'll start then. That's awesome. Again, thank you so much for coming on to the show, and we'd love to have you back in the future sometime. And Jim Ambusky, American Revolution historian aficionado.
Well, Emily, this has been great. Thanks. You know, thanks for really doing to spread the word about history. And that was great. I'll come back anytime.